Ten Bears' first council was inconclusive. But the day after Lieutenant Dunbar's return, another meeting was held, and this time a solid compromise was reached. Instead of leaving immediately, as the young men had wanted, the war party against the Pawnee would take a week to make the necessary preparations. It was also decided that experienced warriors would be included. Wind in His Hair would lead, and Kicking Bird would go along also, providing critical spiritual guidance on the practical matters of choosing campsites and times for attack, as well as divining unforeseen omens, several of which were sure to appear. It was to be a small party of about 20 warriors, and they would be looking for booty rather than revenge. There was great interest in this group because several of the young men would be going out for the first time as full-fledged warriors, and the addition of such distinguished men to lead them produced enough excitement to upset the normally placid routine of Ten Bears' camp. Lieutenant Dunbar's routine, already altered by his strange day and night in the ancient canyon, was upset too. With so much going on, the meetings in the brush arbor were constantly interrupted, and after 2 days of this, they were discontinued. Besieged as he was, Kicking Bird was happy to turn his full attention to planning for the raid. Stands with a Fist was glad for the cooling-off period, and so was Dances with Wolves. It was plain to him that she was making an extra effort to keep her distance, and he was relieved to see the sessions end for that reason, if for no other. Preparations for the war party intrigued him, and he shadowed Kicking Bird as much as he could. The medicine man seemed to be in touch with the entire camp, and Dances with Wolves was delighted to be included, even if it was only to observe. Though far from fluent, he was close now to the gist of what was being said, and had become so proficient in sign language that Stands with a Fist was rarely called upon during the final days before the war party left. It was a first-rate education for the former Lieutenant Dunbar. He sat in on many meetings at which responsibilities were delegated to each member of the party with remarkable care and tact. Reading between the lines, he could see that among Kicking Bird's many outstanding qualities, none counted more than his ability to make each man feel he was a crucially important member of the coming expedition. Dances with Wolves also got to spend time with Wind in His Hair. Because Wind in His Hair had fought the Pawnee on many occasions, his stories of these encounters were in demand. In fact, they were vital to the preparation of the party's younger men. Informal classes in warfare were conducted in and around Wind in His Hair's lodge, and as the days sped by, Dances with Wolves became infected. The infection was low grade at first, nothing more than idle reflections on what the warpath would be like, but eventually he was caught up with a strong desire to take the trail against the Comanche's enemies. He waited patiently for opportune times when he could ask about going along. He had his chances, but the moments came and went without him finding his tongue. He was made shy by the fear of someone saying no. 2 days before the party's scheduled departure, a large herd of antelope was sighted near camp, and a group of warriors, including Dances with Wolves, rode out in search of meat. Using the same surrounding technique they had employed with the buffalo, the men were able to kill a great number of the animals, about 60 head. Fresh meat was always welcome, but more importantly, the appearance and successful hunting of the antelope was taken as a sign that the little war against the Pawnee would have a good result. The men going out would be made secure with the knowledge that their families wouldn't be hard-pressed for food, even if they were gone several weeks. A dance of thanks was held the same evening, and everyone was in high spirits. Everyone but Dances with Wolves. As the night wore on, he watched from a distance, growing more and more morose. He was thinking only of being left behind, and now he could not stand the thought. He maneuvered himself close to Stands with a Fist, and when the dance broke up, he was at her side. "I want to talk to Kicking Bird," he said. Something was wrong, she thought. She read his eyes for clues, but could find none. "When?" "Now." For some reason, he couldn't calm himself down. He was uncharacteristically nervous and fidgety, and as they walked to the lodge, both Stands with a Fist and Kicking Bird could see this. His anxiety was still evident when they had seated themselves in Kicking Bird's teepee. The medicine man skated over the usual formalities and came quickly to the point. "Make your talk," he said, speaking through Stands with a Fist. "I want to go." "Go where?" she asked. Dances with Wolves shifted restlessly, working up his courage. "Against the Pawnee." This was relayed to Kicking Bird. Except for a slight widening of his eyes, the medicine man seemed unfazed. "Why do you want to make war on the Pawnee?" he asked logically. "They have done nothing to you." Dances with Wolves thought for a moment. "They are Comanche enemies." Kicking Bird didn't like it. There was something forced about the request. Dances with Wolves was rushing. "Only Comanche warriors can go on this ride," he said flatly. "I have been a warrior in the white man's army longer than some of the young men who are going have been apprentices. Some of them are making war for the first time." "They have been taught in the Comanche way," the medicine man said gently. "You have not. The white man's way is not the Comanche way." Dances with Wolves lost a little of his resolve then. He knew he was losing. His voice dropped. "I cannot learn the Comanche way of war if I stay in camp," he said lowly. It was difficult for Kicking Bird. He wished it was not happening. His affection for Dances with Wolves was deep. The white soldier had been his responsibility, and the white soldier had shown himself to be worthy of the risks Kicking Bird had taken. He was more than worthy. On the other hand, the medicine man had risen to a high and revered position through the dedicated gathering of wisdom. He was wise now, and was able to understand the world well enough to be of great service to his people. It was between affection for one man and service to his community that Kicking Bird was split. He knew it was no contest. All of his wisdom said it would be wrong to take Dances with Wolves. As he struggled with the question, he heard Dances with Wolves say something to Stance with a Fist. "He asked that you talk to Ten Bears on this," she said. Kicking Bird looked into the hopeful eyes of his protege and hesitated. "I will do that," he answered. Dances with Wolves slept poorly that night. He cursed himself for being too excited to sleep. He knew that no decision would be rendered until the next day, and tomorrow seemed too far away. He slept for 10 minutes and woke for 20 all through the night. Half an hour before dawn, he finally gave it up and went down to the river to bathe. The idea of waiting around camp for word was unbearable, and he jumped at the chance when Wind in His Hair asked if he wanted to go on a buffalo scout. They ranged far to the east, and it was well into the afternoon before they were back in camp. He let Smiles a Lot take Cisco back to the pony herd, and with his heart beating wildly, stepped into Kicking Bird's lodge. No one was there. He was determined to wait until someone returned, but through the back wall he could hear women's voices mixed with the clatter of work, and the longer he listened, the less he could imagine what was going on. Not many minutes passed before curiosity drove him outside. Directly behind Kicking Bird's home, a few yards from the arbor, he found Stance with a Fist, and the medicine man's wives putting the final touches on a newly erected lodge. They were stitching the last of the seams, and he watched them work for a few moments before he spoke. "Where's Kicking Bird?" "With Ten Bears," she said. "I will wait for him," said Dances with Wolves, turning to go. "If you want," she said, not bothering to look up from her work, "you can wait in here." She stopped to brush at the beads of sweat running along her temple and faced him. "We make this for you." The talk with Ten Bears didn't last long, at least the substance of it didn't. The old man was in a good mood. His long-suffering bones loved the hot weather, and though he wasn't going, the prospects for a successful venture against the hated Pawnee delighted him. His grandchildren were round as butterballs from summer feasting, and all three of his wives had been especially cheerful of late. Kicking Bird could not have picked a better time to see him about a delicate matter. As the medicine man told him about Dances with Wolves' request, Ten Bears listened impassively. He repacked his pipe before replying. "You have told me what is in his heart," the old man wheezed. "What is in yours?" He offered Kicking Bird the pipe. "My heart says he is too anxious. He wants too much, too soon. He is a warrior, but he is not a Comanche. He will not be a Comanche for a while." Ten Bears smiled. "You always speak well, Kicking Bird, and you see it well." The old fellow lit the pipe and passed it over. "Now tell me," he said, "what is it you would like my advice on?" It was a terrible letdown at first. The only thing he could compare it to was a reduction in rank. But it was more disappointing than that. He had never been so disappointed. And yet he was shocked at how quickly the hurt of it passed. It was gone almost as soon as Kicking Bird and Stands with a Fist left the lodge. He lay on the new bed in his new home and wondered about this change. It had only been minutes since he got the word, but he wasn't crushed at all now. It was a tiny disappointment now. "It's something to do with being here," he thought. "Being with these people. It's something to do with being unspoiled." Kicking Bird had done everything very precisely. He came trailed by the two women carrying robes, Stands with a Fist and one of his wives. After they'd made up the new bed, the wife had departed, and the three, Kicking Bird, Stands with a Fist, and Dances with Wolves, had stood facing one another in the center of the teepee. Kicking Bird had never made mention of the raid or of the decision that had gone against him. He just started talking. "It would be good if you make talk with Stance with a Fist while I'm gone. You should do this in my lodge so that my family can see. I want them to know you while I'm gone, and I want you to know them. I will feel better to know that you are looking after my family while I'm away. Come to my fire and eat if you are hungry." Once the invitation to dinner was made, the medicine man turned abruptly and left, Stance with a Fist following him. As he watched them go, Dances with Wolves was surprised to feel his depression evaporating. In its place was a feeling of elation. He didn't feel small at all. He felt bigger. Kicking Bird's family would be under his protection, and the idea of serving him in that role was one he looked forward to instantly. He would be with Stans with a Fist again, and that too gave him heart. The war party would be gone for some time, thus giving him the chance to learn a lot of Comanche. And in learning, he knew he would be picking up more than language. If he worked very hard, he would be on a whole new level by the time his mentors returned. He liked that idea. Drums had started up in the village. The big send-off dance was beginning, and he wanted to go. He loved the dancing. Dances with Wolves rolled off his bed and looked around his lodge. It was empty, but before long it would hold the slim trappings of his life, and it was pleasant to think about having something to call his own again. He stepped through the lodge flap and paused in the twilight outside. He had daydreamed his way past dinner, but the wood smoke from the cooking fires was still thick in the air, and the smell of it satisfied him. A thought came to Dances with Wolves then. "I should be staying here," he said to himself. "It's much the better idea." He started off toward the sound of drums. When he reached the main avenue, he fell in with a pair of warriors he knew. In signs, they asked him if he would dance tonight. Dances with Wolves' reply was so positive that it made the men laugh. Once the party was away, the village settled into a life of pastoral routine, a timeless rotation of dawn to day to dusk to night that made the prairie seem the only place on earth. Dances with Wolves fell quickly into step with the cycle, moving through it in a pleasant, dreamlike way. A life of riding and hunting and scouting was physically taxing, but his body had adapted well, and once the rhythm of his days was established, he found most activities effortless. Kicking Bird's family required much of his time. The women did virtually all of the work around camp, but he felt obliged to monitor their day-to-day lives and those of the children, the result being that somehow his hands were always full. Wind in His Hair had presented him with a good bow and a quiver of arrows at the farewell dance. He was thrilled with the gift and sought out an older warrior named Stonecalf, who taught him the finer points of its use. In the space of a week, the two became fast friends, and Dances with Wolves showed up regularly at Stonecalf's lodge. He learned how to care for and make quick repairs on weapons. He learned the words to several important songs and how to sing them. He watched Stonecalf make fire from a little wooden kit and saw him make his own personal medicine. He was a willing pupil for these lessons and quick to learn, so quick that Stonecalf gave him the nickname Fast. He scouted a few hours each day, as did most of the other men. They went out in groups of three or four, and in a short time Dances with Wolves had a rudimentary knowledge of necessary things, like how to read the age of tracks and determine weather patterns. The buffalo came and went in their mysterious way. Some days they would see none at all, and some days they would see so many that it became a joke. On the 2 points that counted, the scouting was a success. There was fresh meat for the taking, and the countryside was devoid of enemies. After only a few days, he was wondering why everyone didn't live in a lodge. When he thought of the places he had lived before, he could envision nothing but a collection of sterile rooms. To him, the lodge was a true home. It was cool on the hottest days, and no matter what sort of fuss was going on in camp, the circle of space inside seemed filled with peace. He came to love the time he passed there by himself. His favorite part of the day was late afternoon, and more often than not, he could be found close to the lodge flap, performing some little job like cleaning his boots, while he watched the clouds change formation or listened to the light whistle of wind. Without really trying, these late afternoons by himself shut down the machinery of his mind, letting it rest in a refreshing way. It didn't take long, however, for one facet of his life to dominate all the others. That was Stans with a Fist. Their talks began again, this time under the casual but always present eyes of Kicking Bird's family. The medicine man had left instructions to keep meeting, but without Kicking Bird to guide them, there was no clear-cut direction for the lessons to take. The first few days consisted mainly of mechanical, unexciting reviews. In a way, it was just as well. She was still confused and embarrassed. The dryness of their first one-on-one meetings made it easier to pick up the thread of the past. It allowed her needed distance in getting used to him again. Dances with Wolves was content to have it that way. The tedium of their exchanges was measured against his sincere desire to patch up whatever had damaged the link between them, and he waited patiently through the first few days, hoping for a thaw. The Comanche was coming well, but it soon became apparent that sitting in the lodge all morning placed limitations on how fast he could learn it. So many things he needed to know about were outside, and family interruptions were never-ending. But he waited on without complaint, letting Stans with a Fist skip over words she couldn't explain. One afternoon, just after the noon meal, when she couldn't find a word for grass, Stans with a Fist finally took him outside. One word led to another, and on that day they didn't return to the lodge for more than an hour. Instead, they strolled through the village, so intent on their studies that time ran out with little thought of its passage. The pattern was repeated and reinforced in the days that followed. They became a common sight, a pair of talkers, roving the village, oblivious to all but the objects comprising their work. Bone, lodge flap, sun, hoof, kettle, dog, stick, sky, child, hair, robe, face, far, near, here, there, bright, dull, and on and on and on. Every day the language took deeper root in him, and soon Dances with Wolves could make more than words. Sentences were forming, and he strung them together with a zeal that caused many mistakes. Fire grows on the prairie. Eating water is good for me. Is that man a bone? He was like a good runner who falls every third stride, but he kept hacking at the morass of the new language, and by sheer force of will, he made remarkable progress. No amount of failure could flag his spirits, and he scrambled over every obstacle with the kind of good humor and determination that makes a person fun. They were in the lodge less and less. The outside was free, and a special quiet was now in place over the village. It had become unusually peaceful. Everyone was thinking about the men who had gone out to face uncertain events in the country of the Pawnee. With each timeless day, relatives and friends of the men in the war party prayed more devoutly for their safety. Overnight, it seemed prayers had become the single most obvious feature of camp life, finding their way into every meal, meeting, and job, no matter how small or fleeting. The holiness that shrouded the camp gave Dances with Wolves and Stands with a Fist a perfect environment in which to operate. Sunk as they were in this time of waiting and prayer, other people paid little attention to the white couple. They moved around in a serene, well-protected bubble, an entity unto themselves. They shared 3 or 4 hours each day, without touching and without talking about themselves. On the surface, a careful formality was observed. They laughed at things together, and they commented on ordinary phenomena like the weather. But feelings about themselves lay concealed at all times. Stands with a Fist was being careful with her feelings, and Dances with Wolves respected that. A profound change took place 2 weeks after the party went out. Late one afternoon, after a long scout under a brutal sun, Dances with Wolves returned to Kicking Bird's lodge, found no one there, and thinking the family had gone to the river, headed down to the water. Kicking Bird's wives were there, scrubbing their children. Stands with a Fist was not around. He hung about long enough to get splashed by the kids and climb back up the path to the village. The sun was still brutal, and when he saw the arbor, the thought of its shade pulled him over. He was halfway inside before he realized she was there. The regular session had already been held, and both of them were embarrassed. Dances with Wolves sat down at a modest distance from her and said hello. It is hot, she answered, as if making an excuse for her presence. Yes, he agreed, very hot. Though he didn't have to, he swiped at his forehead. It was a silly way of making sure she could see he was here for the same reason. But as he made a fake gesture, Dances with Wolves checked himself. A sudden urge had come over him, an urge to tell her how he felt. He just started to talk. He told her he was confused. He told her how good it felt to be here. He told her about the lodge and how good it was to have it. He took the breastplate in both hands and told her how he thought of it, that to him it was something great. He lifted it to his cheek and said, I love this. Then he said, but I'm white, and I'm a soldier. Is it good for me to be here, or is it a foolish thing? Am I foolish? He could see complete attention in her eyes. I don't know, she answered. There was a little silence. He could see she was waiting. I don't know where to go, he said quietly. I don't know where to be. She turned her head slowly and stared out the doorway. I know, she said. She was still lost in thought, staring out at the afternoon when he said, I want to be here. She turned back to him. Her face looked huge. The sinking sun had given it a soft glow. Her eyes, wide with feeling, had the same glow. Yes, she said, understanding exactly how he felt. She dropped her head. When she looked back up, Dances with Wolves felt swallowed, just as he had felt out on the prairie with Timmins for the first time. Her eyes were the eyes of a soulful person, filled with a beauty few men could know. They were eternal. Dances with Wolves fell in love when he saw this. Stands with a Fist had already fallen in love. It happened at the time he began to speak, not all at once, but in slow stages, until at last she could not deny it. She saw herself in him. She saw that they could be one. They talked a little more and fell silent. For a few minutes they stared at the afternoon, each knowing what the other was feeling but not daring to speak. The spell was broken when one of Kicking Bird's little boys happened by, looking inside, and asked what they were doing. Stands with a Fist smiled at his innocent intrusion and told him in Comanche, It is hot. We are sitting in the shade. This made so much sense to the little boy that he came in and flopped onto Dances with Wolves' lap. They wrestled playfully for a few minutes, but the roughhousing didn't last long. The little boy suddenly sat up and told Stans with a fist he was hungry. "All right," she said in Comanche, and took him by the hand. She looked at Dances with Wolves. "Eat?" "Yes, I'm hungry." They crawled out of the arbor's doorway and started for Kicking Bird's lodge to get a cooking fire going. His first order of business the next morning was to visit Stonecalf. He dropped by the warrior's lodge early and was immediately invited to sit down and have breakfast. After they'd eaten, the two men went outside to talk while Stonecalf worked on forming the willow for a new batch of arrows. Except for Stans with a fist, it was the most sophisticated conversation he'd had with anyone. Stonecalf was impressed that this Dances with Wolves, so new among them, was talking in Comanche already, and talking well. The old warrior could also tell that Dances with Wolves wanted something, and when the discussion suddenly shifted to Stans with a fist, he knew that this must be it. Dances with Wolves tried to put it as casually as he could, but Stonecalf was too much the old fox not to see that the question was important to his visitor. "Is Stans with a fist married?" "Yes," Stonecalf replied. The revelation hit Dances with Wolves like the worst kind of news. He was silent. "Where is her husband?" he finally asked. "I did not see him." "He is dead." This was a possibility he had never considered. "When did he die?" Stonecalf looked up from his work. "It is impolite to talk of the dead," he said. "But you are new, so I will tell you. It was around the time of the cherry moon in spring. She was grieving on the day you found her and brought her back." Dances with Wolves didn't ask any more questions, but Stonecalf volunteered a few more facts. He mentioned the relatively high standing of the dead man and the absence of children in his marriage to Stans with a fist. Needing to digest what he had heard, Dances with Wolves thanked his informant and walked off. Stonecalf wondered idly if there might be something going on between these people, and deciding it was none of his business, he went back to work. Dances with Wolves did the one thing he could count on to clear his head. He found Sisko in the pony herd and rode out of the village. He knew she would be waiting for him in Kicking Bird's lodge, but his mind was spinning wildly with what he'd been told, and he couldn't think of facing her now. He went downriver, and after a mile or two decided to go all the way to Fort Sedgwick. He hadn't been there for almost 2 weeks, and felt an impulse to go now, as if in some strange way the place might be able to tell him something. Even from a distance, he could see that the late summer storms had finished the awning. It had been torn away from most of the staves. The canvas itself was badly shredded. What was left was flapping in the breeze like the ragged mainsail of a ghost ship. Two Socks was waiting near the bluff, and he threw the old fellow the slab of jerked meat he'd brought along for nibbling. He wasn't hungry. Field mice scattered as he peeked into the rotted supply house. They'd destroyed the only thing he'd left behind, a burlap sack filled with moldy hardtack. In a sod hut that had been his home, he lay down on the little bunk for a few minutes and stared at the crumbling walls. He took his father's broken pocket watch off its peg, intending to slip it into his trouser pocket. But he looked at it for a few seconds and put it back. His father had been dead 6 years. Or was it 7? His mother had been dead even longer. He could recall the details of his life with them, but the people seemed like they'd been gone 100 years. He noticed the journal sitting on one of the camp stools and picked it up. It was odd, leafing through the entries. They too seemed old and gone, like something from a past life. Sometimes he laughed at what he had written, but on the whole, he was moved. His life had been made over, and pieces of the record were set down here. It was only a curiosity now and had no bearing on his future, but it was interesting to look back and see how far he had come. When he reached the end, there were some blank pages, and he had the whimsical idea that a postscript was in order, something clever and mysterious, perhaps. But when he raised his eyes to think, against the blankness of the sod wall, he saw only her. He saw the well-muscled calves flashing from under the hem of her everyday doeskin dress. He saw the long, beautiful hands extending gracefully from its sleeves. He saw the loose curve of her breasts beneath its bodice. He saw the high cheeks and the heavy, expressive brows, and the eternal eyes, and the mop of tangled, cherry-colored hair. He thought of her sudden rages, and of the light surrounding her face in the arbor. He thought of her modesty and dignity, and of her pain. Everything he saw and everything he thought of, he adored. When his eyes fell back on the blank page spread on his lap, he knew what to write. He was overjoyed to see it come alive in words. Late summer, 1863. I love stands with a fist. Dances with wolves. He closed the journal and placed it carefully on the center of the bed, thinking capriciously that he would leave it for posterity to puzzle over. When he walked outside, Dances with Wolves was relieved to see that Two Socks had disappeared. Knowing he would not see him again, he said a prayer for his grandfather the wolf, wishing him a good life for all his remaining years. Then he vaulted onto Cisco's sturdy back, whooped a goodbye in Comanche, and galloped away at full speed. When he looked over his shoulder at Fort Sedgwick, he saw only open, rolling prairie. She waited almost an hour before one of Kicking Bird's wives asked, "Where's Dances with Wolves?" The waiting had been very hard. Each minute had been filled with thoughts of him. When the question was asked, she tried to construct her answer with a tone that shielded what she felt. "Oh, yes, Dances with Wolves. No, I don't know where he is." She went outside then to ask around. Someone had seen him leaving early, riding to the south, and she guessed correctly that he had gone to the white man's fort. Not wanting to know why he had gone, she threw herself into finishing the saddlebags she'd been working on, trying to blot out the distractions of the camp so that she could focus only on him. But it wasn't enough. She wanted to be alone with him, even if it was just in her thoughts, and after the noon meal she took the main path down to the river. Usually there was a lull following lunch, and she was pleased to find no one at the water's edge. She took off her moccasins, walked onto a thick log that ran out like a pier, and straddling it, dipped her feet into the cooling shallows. There was only a hint of breeze, but it was enough to blunt the day's heat. She placed a hand on each thigh, relaxed her shoulders, and gazed at the slow-moving river with half-closed eyes. If he came for her now, if he looked at her with those strong eyes and laughed his funny laugh and said they were going, she would go right now, the where not mattering. Suddenly she remembered their first meeting, clear as if it were yesterday. Riding back half-conscious, her blood all over him, she remembered the safety she had felt, his arm around her back, her face pressed against the strange-smelling fabric of his jacket. Now she was understanding what it meant. She understood that what she felt now was what she felt then. Then it had only been a seed, buried and out of sight, and she hadn't known what it meant. But the Great Spirit knew. The Great Spirit had let the seed grow. The Great Spirit, in all its great mystery, had encouraged the seed to life every step of the way. That feeling she had, that feeling of safety, she knew now that it was not the safety felt in the face of an enemy, or a storm, or an injury. It was not a physical thing at all. It was a safety she had felt in her heart. It had been there all along. The rarest of all things in this life had happened. The Great Spirit had brought them together. She was reeling with the wonder of how it had all come to pass when she heard a gentle lapping of water a few feet away. He was squatting on a little patch of beach, splashing water on his face in a slow, unhurried way. He looked at her, and without bothering to wipe at the water dripping down his face, he smiled just like a little boy. "Hello," he said. "I was at the fort." He said this as if they had been together all their lives. She replied in the same way, "I know." "Can we make some talk?" "Yes," she said, "I was waiting to do that." Voices sounded in the distance near the top of the trail. "Where should we go?" he asked. "I know a place." She got quickly to her feet, and with Dances with Wolves a step or two behind, led him to the old side path she had taken the day Kicking Bird asked her to remember the white tongue. They walked in silence, surrounded by the soft plod of their footsteps, the rustling of willows, and the singing of the birds who infested the brakes. Inside, their hearts were pounding with the suspicion of what was about to happen, and the suspense of where and when it would take place. The secluded clearing where she had recalled the past finally opened to them. Still silent, they sat down cross-legged in front of the big cottonwood that faced the river. They could not speak. All other sounds seemed to stop. Everything was still. Stance with a Fist dipped her head and saw a rent in the seam of his trouser leg. His hand was resting there, halfway up his thigh. "They are torn," she whispered, letting her fingers lightly touch the tear. Once her hand was there, she could not move it. The little fingers lay together unmoving. As if guided by some outside force, their heads came together softly, their fingers entwined. The touching was rapturous as sex itself. Neither could have retraced the sequence of how it happened, but a moment later they were sharing a kiss. It wasn't a big kiss, just a brushing and then a slight pressing together of their lips, but it sealed the love between them. They placed their cheeks together, and as each nose filled with the smell of the other, they fell into a dream. In the dream they made love, and when they had finished and were lying side by side beneath a big cottonwood, Dances with Wolves looked into her eyes and saw tears. He waited a long time, but she wouldn't speak. "Tell me," he whispered. "I'm happy," she said. "I'm happy the Great Spirit has let me live this long." "I have the same feeling," he said, his eyes welling. She pressed tightly against him then and began to cry. He held her hard as she wept, unafraid of the joy that was running down her face. They made love all afternoon, having long talks in between. When shadows finally began to fall across the clearing, they sat up, both sensing they would be missed if they stayed much longer. They were watching the glint on the water when he said, "I talked to Stonecalf. I know why you ran off that day, the day I asked you if you were married." She rose up then and extended her hand. He took it and she pulled him to his feet. "I had a good life with him," she said. "He went away from me because you were coming. That is how I see it." She led him out of the clearing and they started back, clinging to each other as they walked. When they were within hearing of the faint voices calling from the village, they halted to listen. The main trail was just ahead. With a squeeze of their hands, the lovers slipped intuitively into the willows, and as if it would help them get through the coming night of separation, they came together again, making it fast as a hurried goodbye kiss. A step or two from the main path leading up to the village, they stopped once more, and as they embraced, she whispered in his ear, "I'm in mourning, and our people would not approve if they knew of our love. We must guard our love carefully until the time comes for all to see it." He nodded his understanding, they hugged briefly, and she slipped through the undergrowth. Dances with Wolves waited in the willows for 10 minutes and then followed. He was glad to find himself alone as he shuffled up the hill to the village. He went straight to his lodge and sat on his bed, staring through the lodge flap at what was left of the light, dreaming of their afternoon in front of the cottonwood. When it was dark, he lay back on the thick robes and realized that he was exhausted. As he rolled over, he discovered the smell of her lingering on one of his hands. Hoping it would stay all through the night, he drifted off to sleep. The next few days were euphoric for Dances with Wolves and Stands with the Fist. There were constant smiles about their mouths. Their cheeks were flushed with romance, and no matter where they went, their feet seemed not to touch the ground. In the company of others, they were discreet, being careful not to show any outward signs of affection. So geared were they for concealment that the language sessions were more businesslike than ever before. If they were alone in the lodge, they took the chance of holding hands, making love with their fingers. But that was as far as it went. They tried to meet secretly at least once a day, usually at the river. This they couldn't help doing, but it took time to find absolute seclusion, and Stands with a Fist in particular fretted about being found out. Marriage was in their minds from the beginning. It was something they both wanted, and the sooner the better. But her widowhood was a major stumbling block. There was no prescribed period of mourning in the Comanche lifeway, and release could only come from the woman's father. If she had no father, the warrior who was her primary provider would take on the responsibility. In Stands with a Fist case, she could only look to Kicking Bird for her release. He alone would determine when she was no longer a widow, and it might take a long time. Dances with Wolves tried to reassure his lover, telling her that things would work out and not to worry. But she did anyway. During one fit of depression over this issue, she proposed that they run away together. But he only laughed, and the idea was not brought up again. They took chances. Twice in the 4 days after their coming together at the river, she left Kicking Bird's lodge in the darkness of early morning and slipped unnoticed into Dances with Wolves' teepee. There they would lie together until first light, whispering their conversations as they held each other naked under the robe. All in all, they did well as could be expected of two people who had surrendered completely to love. They were dignified and prudent and disciplined, and they fooled almost no one. Everyone in the camp who was old enough to know what love between a man and a woman looked like could see it in the faces of Stands with a Fist and Dances with Wolves. Most people could not find it in their hearts to condemn love, no matter what the circumstances. Those few who might have taken offense held their tongues for lack of proof. Most important, their attraction was no threat to the band at large. Even the older conservative elements admitted to themselves that the potential union made sense. After all, they were both white. On the fifth night after the meeting at the river, Stands with a Fist had to see him again. She had been waiting for everyone in Kicking Bird's lodge to fall asleep. Long after the sounds of light snoring filled the teepee, she was waiting, wanting to make sure her leaving would go unnoticed. She had just realized that the smell of rain was strong in the air when a sudden yapping of excited voices broke the stillness. The voices were loud enough to wake everyone, and seconds later they were throwing aside bedding to rush outside. Something had happened. The whole village was up. She hurried down the main avenue with a throng of other people, all of them heading for a big fire that seemed to be the center of attention. In the chaos, she looked vainly for Dances with Wolves, but it wasn't until she had pushed close to the fire that she could see him. As they sifted through the crowd to one another, she noticed new Indians huddled by the fire. There were half a dozen of them. Several more men were sprawled on the ground, some of them dead, some of them horribly injured. They were Kiowas, longtime friends and hunting partners of the Comanche. The six men who were untouched were wild with fear. They were gesticulating anxiously, talking in signs to Ten Bears and two or three close advisors. The onlookers were hushed and expectant as they watched the Kiowa story unfold. She and Dances with Wolves had nearly closed the space between them when women began to scream. A moment later, the assembly came to pieces as women and children ran for their lodges, careening into each other in their panic. Warriors were boiling around Ten Bears, and one word was coming from the mouths of everyone. It was rolling through the village in the same way that thunder had begun to tremble through the black skies overhead. It was a word Dances with Wolves knew well, for he had heard it many times in conversations and stories. Pawnee. With Stance with a fist at his side, he pressed closer to the warriors crowding around Ten Bears. She talked into his ear as they watched, telling him what had happened to the Kiowa. They had started out as a small group, less than 20 men, looking for buffalo about 10 miles north of the Comanche camp. There they were hit by a huge Pawnee war party, at least 80 warriors, maybe more. They'd been attacked in the afterglow of sunset, and none of them would have escaped were it not for darkness and a superior knowledge of the countryside. They'd covered the retreat as best they could, but with such a large army it was only a matter of time before the Pawnee would locate this camp. It was possible they had moved into position even now. The Kiowas thought there would be a few hours at most to get ready. That there would be an attack, probably made at dawn, was a foregone conclusion. Ten Bears began giving orders that neither Stance with a Fist nor Dances with Wolves could hear. It was clear from the old man's expression, however, that he was worried. 10 of the band's most distinguished warriors were out with Kicking Bird and Wind in his hair. The men left behind were good fighters, but if there were 80 Pawnee coming, they would be dangerously outnumbered. The meeting around the fire broke up in a curious kind of anarchy, lesser warriors marching off in different directions behind the men they felt would best lead them. Dances with Wolves had an uneasy feeling. Everything seemed so disorganized. The thunder overhead was coming at closer intervals, and rain seemed inevitable. It would help to cover the Pawnee approach. But it was his village now, and he dashed after Stonecalf with only one thought in mind. "I will follow you," he said when he had caught up. Stonecalf eyed him grimly. "This will be a hard fight," he said. "The Pawnee never come for horses. They come for blood." Dances with Wolves nodded. "Get your weapons and come to my lodge," the older warrior ordered. "I'll get them," Stance with a Fist volunteered, and with her dress hitched up around her calves, she took off at a run, leaving Dances with Wolves to follow Stonecalf. He was trying to calculate how many rounds he had for the rifle and his navy revolver when he remembered something that stopped him in his tracks. "Stonecalf," he shouted. "Stonecalf!" The warrior turned back to him. "I have guns," Dances with Wolves blurted. "In the ground near the white man's fort there are many guns." They made an immediate about-face and returned to the fire. Ten Bears was still questioning Kiowa hunters. The poor men, already half-crazed at the trauma of nearly losing their lives, shrank at the sight of Dances with Wolves, and it took some quick talking to get them calmed down. Ten Bears' face jumped when Stonecalf told him there were guns. "What guns?" he asked anxiously. "White soldier guns, rifles," answered Dances with Wolves. It was a hard decision for Ten Bears. Though he approved of Dances with Wolves, there was something in his old Comanche blood that didn't fully trust the white man. The guns were in the ground, and it would take time to dig them up. The Pawnee might be close now, and he needed every man to defend the village. There was the long ride to the white man's fort to consider, and the rain would be coming any minute. But the fight was going to be a close one, and he knew that guns could make a big difference. Chances were the Pawnee didn't have many. Dawn was still hours away, and there was enough time to make the round trip to the Haremouth fort. "The guns are in boxes. They are covered with wood," Dances with Wolves said, interrupting his thoughts. "We will need only a few men in Travoy to bring them back." The old man had to make the gamble. He told Stonecalf to take Dances with Wolves along with 2 other men and 6 ponies, 4 for riding and 2 for carrying the guns. He told him to go quickly. When he got to his lodge, Sisko was bridled and standing in front. A fire was going inside, and Stance with a Fist was squatting next to it, mixing something in a small bowl. His weapons, the rifle, the big navy, the bow, the quiver stuffed with arrows, and the long-bladed knife were laid out neatly on the floor. He was strapping on the navy when she brought the bowl to him. "Give me your face," she commanded. He stood still as she daubed at the red substance in the bowl with one of her fingers. "This is for you to do, but there is no time and you don't know how. I will do it for you." With fast, sure strokes, she drew a single horizontal bar across his forehead and 2 vertical ones along each cheek. Using a dot pattern, she superimposed a wolf's paw print over one of the cheek bars and stepped back to look at her work. She nodded approval as Dances with Wolves slung the bow and quiver over his shoulder. "You can shoot?" he asked. "Yes," she said. "Take this, then." He handed her the rifle. There were no hugs or words of goodbye. He stepped outside, jumped up on Sisko, and was gone. They rode away from the river, taking the straightest line possible across the grasslands. The sky was terrifying. It seemed as though four storms were converging at once. Lightning was flashing all around them like artillery fire. They had to stop when one of the travoy came loose from its rigging, and as it was being repaired, Dances with Wolves had a chilling thought. What if he couldn't find the guns? He hadn't seen the buffalo rib marker for a long time. Even if it was still standing where he'd driven it into the ground, it would be difficult to find. He groaned inwardly at his prospects. Rain was beginning to fall in big, heavy drops when they reached the fort. He led them to what he thought was the spot, but could see nothing in the dark. He told them what to look for, and the quartet fanned out on their ponies, searching the tall grass for a long, white piece of bone. Rain was coming harder now, and 10 minutes passed with no sign of the rib. The wind was up, and lightning was flashing every few seconds. The light it threw across the ground was countered by the blinding effect it had on the searchers. After 20 dismal minutes, Dances with Wolves' heart had hit bottom. They were covering the same ground now, and still there was nothing. Then, over the wind and rain and thunder, he thought he heard a cracking sound under one of Sisko's hooves. Dances with Wolves called to the others and leapt down. Soon, all four were on their hands and knees, feeling blindly through the grass. Stonecalf suddenly jumped to his feet. He was waving a long, white piece of the rib. Dances with Wolves stood in the spot where it was found and waited for the next bolt of lightning. When the sky flashed again, he glanced quickly at the old buildings of Fort Sedgwick, and using them as a landmark, began moving in a northerly direction, going step by step. A few paces later, the prairie went spongy under one of his boots, and he cried out to the others. The men dropped down to help him dig. The earth gave easily as they scooped, and minutes later, two long wooden cases of rifles were being hauled out of their muddy tomb. They'd been underway only half an hour when a storm hit with full power, sending rain down in great running sheets. It was impossible to see, and the four men shepherding the two travoy across the plains had to grope their way back. But with the importance of their mission uppermost in each man's mind, they never paused and made the return trip in amazing time. When at last they were in sight of the village, the storm had died down. Above it, a few long streaks of gray had appeared in the turbulent sky, and through this first feeble light of day, they could see that the village was still safe. They had just started down the depression leading to camp when a spectacular barrage of lightning struck upriver. For 2 or 3 seconds, the bolts lit the landscape with the clarity of daylight. Dances with Wolves saw it, and so did the others. A long line of horsemen was crossing the river no more than half a mile above the village. The lightning struck again, and they could see the enemy disappearing into the breaks. The plan was obvious. They would come from the north, using the foliage along the river to move within 100 yards of the village. Then they would attack. In perhaps 20 minutes, the Pawnee would be in position. There were 24 rifles in each crate. Dances with Wolves personally passed them out to the fighting men clustered around Ten Bears' lodge, while the old man gave last-minute instructions. Though he knew that the main assault would be coming from the river, it was probable that they would send a diversionary force from the open prairie, thus giving the real attackers a chance to overrun the village from behind. He designated 2 influential warriors and a handful of followers to fight off the suspected charge from the prairie. Then he tapped Dances with Wolves on the shoulder, and the warriors listened as he spoke. "If you were a white soldier," the old man said wryly, "and you had all these men with guns, what would you do?" Dances with Wolves quickly thought this over. "I would hide in the village." Cries of derision flew from the mouths of the warriors who had been within earshot. Ten Bears quieted them with a raising of his hand. "Dances with Wolves has not finished his answer," he said sternly. "I would hide in the village behind the lodges. I would watch only the breaks and not those coming from the prairie. I would let the enemy show himself first. I would let the enemy think we are fighting on the other side and that taking the camp will be easy. Then I would have these men hiding behind the lodges jump out and shoot. Then I would have these men charge the enemy with knives and skullcrackers. I would drive the enemy into the river and kill so many that they would never come this way again." The old man had been listening carefully. He looked out over his warriors and lifted his voice. "Dances with Wolves and I are of the same mind. We should kill so many that they will never come this way again. Let us go quietly." The men moved stealthily through the village with their new rifles and took up positions behind lodges that faced the river. Before he took his place beside them, Dances with Wolves slipped into Kicking Bird's lodge. The children had been herded under robes. Sitting in silence beside them were the women. Kicking Bird's wives were holding clubs in their laps. Stance with a Fist had his rifle. They said nothing, and neither did Dances with Wolves. He'd only wanted to see that they were ready. He stole past the arbor and stopped behind his own lodge. It was one of the closest to the river. Stonecalf was on the other side. They nodded at each other and turned their attention to the open ground in front of them. It sloped for about 100 yards before it met the breaks. The rain was much lighter, but it still served to obscure their view. Clouds hung thickly overhead, and the half-light of dawn was almost no light at all. They could see little, but he felt sure they were there. Dances with Wolves glanced up and down the line of teepees to his left and right. Comanche warriors were packed in behind each one, waiting with their rifles. Even Ten Bears was there. The light was stronger now, the storm clouds were lifting, and the rain was going with them. Suddenly the sun broke through, and a minute later steam was rising off the ground like fog. Dances with Wolves squinted through the fog at the breaks, and saw the dark shapes of men, sifting like spirits through the willows and cottonwoods. He was starting to feel something he had not felt in a long time. It was that intangible thing that turned his eyes black, that turned on the machine that could not be shut down. No matter how big, how many, or how powerful the men moving in the mist were, they were nothing to fear. They were the enemy, and they were on his doorstep. He wanted to fight them. He couldn't wait to fight them. Gunshots rang out behind him. The diversionary force had hit the small group of defenders on the other front. As the noise of the fighting increased, his eyes checked the line. A few hotheads tried to break away and run to the other fight, but the older warriors did a good job of holding them in check, and no one bolted. Again he scanned the mists clinging to the breaks. They were coming up slowly, some on foot, some on horseback. They were inching up the incline, shadowy, roach-haired enemies dreaming of a slaughter. The Pawnee cavalry was behind the men on foot, and Dances with Wolves wanted them at the front. He wanted the mounted men to take the brunt of the fire. "Bring up the horses," he pleaded to them silently. "Bring 'em up." He looked down the line, hoping they would wait a few more seconds, and was surprised to see so many eyes riveted on him. They kept watching, as if waiting for a sign. Dances with Wolves raised an arm over his head. A fluttering, guttural sound came up the slope. It rose higher and higher, blasting through the quiet, rainy morning like hot air. The Pawnee were sounding the attack. As they charged, the cavalry surged ahead of the men on foot. Dances with Wolves dropped his arm and sprang out from behind the lodge with his rifle raised. The other Comanches followed suit. The fire from their guns hit the horsemen at a distance of about 20 yards, and as cleanly as a sharp knife cutting skin, it wrecked the Pawnee charge. Men tumbled from their horses like toys shaken off a shelf, and those not actually hit were stunned by the blistering concussion of 40 rifles. As they fired, the Comanches counterattacked, streaming down through the screen of blue smoke to pounce on the dazed enemy. The charge was so furious that Dances with Wolves crashed square into the first Pawnee he met. As they rolled awkwardly on the ground, he thrust the barrel of the Navy into the man's face and fired. After that, he shot men where he could find them in the turmoil, killing 2 more in rapid succession. Something large bumped him hard from behind, nearly knocking him off his feet. It was one of the surviving Pawnee war ponies. He grabbed its bridle and swung onto its back. The Pawnee were like chickens being set upon by wolves, and already they were falling back, desperately trying to make the safety of the breaks. Dances with Wolves picked out a tall warrior running for his life and rode him down. He fired at the back of the man's head, but there was no report. Flipping the barrel around, he clubbed the fleeing warrior with the butt end of the revolver. The Pawnee went down right in front of him, and Dances with Wolves felt the pony's hoofs strike the body as they passed over. Just ahead of him, another Pawnee, his head turbaned with a bright red scarf, was picking himself off the ground. He, too, was going for the breaks. Dances with Wolves kicked viciously at his pony's flanks, and as they pulled abreast of the runaway, he threw himself at the turbaned man, taking him in a headlock as he slid from the pony's back. Momentum sent them careening across the last of the open space, and they slammed hard against a large cottonwood. Dances with Wolves had the man by both sides of his head. He was bashing his skull against the tree trunk before he realized that the warrior's eyes were dead. A broken branch, low on the trunk, had skewered the Pawnee like meat. As he stepped back from this unnerving sight, the dead man slumped forward, his arms flopping pitifully against Dances with Wolves' sides, as if he wanted to embrace his killer. Dances with Wolves skipped back farther, and the body fell flat on its face. In the same instant, he realized that the screaming had stopped. The fight was over. Suddenly weak, he staggered along the edge of the breaks, picked up the main path, and trotted down to the river, sidestepping Pawnee bodies as he went. A dozen mounted Comanches, Stonecalf among them, were chasing the dregs of the Pawnee force up the opposite bank. Dances with Wolves watched until the skirmishers disappeared from sight. Then he walked slowly back. Coming up the incline, he could hear yelling. When he reached the slope's crest, the battlefield he'd lately occupied opened wide to him. It looked like a hastily abandoned picnic site. Refuse was scattered everywhere. There were a great number of Pawnee corpses. Comanche warriors were moving among them excitedly. "I killed this one," someone would call. "This one still breathes," another would announce, prompting the arrival of whoever was close by to help finish him off. The women and children had come out of the lodges and were scurrying down to the battlefield. Some of the bodies were being mutilated. Dances with Wolves stood stock still, too fatigued to retreat into the breaks, too repulsed to move forward. One of the warriors saw him and then cried out, "Dances with Wolves!" Before he knew it, Comanche fighters were all around him. Like ants rolling a pebble uphill, they pushed him onto the battlefield. They were chanting his name as they went. In a daze, he allowed himself to be carried along, unable to comprehend their intense happiness. They were overjoyed at the death and destruction lying at their feet, and Dances with Wolves could not understand. But as he stood there, hearing them shout his name, understanding came to him. He had never been in this kind of fight, but gradually he began to look at the victory in a new way. This killing had not been done in the name of some dark political objective. This was not a battle for territory or riches, or to make men free. This battle had no ego. It had been waged to protect the homes that stood only a few feet away, and to protect the wives and children and loved ones huddled inside. It had been fought to preserve the food stores that would see them through the winter, food stores everyone had worked so hard to gather. For every member of the band, this was a great personal victory. Suddenly, he was proud to hear his name being shouted, and as his eyes focused again, he looked down and recognized one of the men he had killed. "I shot this one," he yelled out. Someone shouted in his ear, "Yes, I saw you shoot him." Before long, Dances with Wolves was marching around with them, calling out the names of fellow Comanche men as he recognized them. Sunshine spilled across the village, and the fighters began a spontaneous dance of victory, exhorting each other with backslaps and cries of triumph as they cavorted over the field of dead Pawnee. Two of the enemy had been killed by the force defending the front of the village. On the main battlefield, there were 22 bodies. Four more were found in the breaks, and Stonecalf's team of pursuers managed to kill three. How many had gotten away wounded, no one knew. Seven Comanches had been wounded, only two seriously. But the real miracle was in the number of dead. Not a single Comanche fighter had been lost. Even the old men could not remember such a one-sided victory. For 2 days, the village reveled in its triumph. Honors were heaped on all the men, but one warrior was exalted above all others. That was Dances with Wolves. Through all his months on the plains, the native perception of him had shifted many times. And now the circle had closed. Now he was looked on in a way that was close to their original idea. No one came forward to declare him a god, but in the life of these people, he was the next best thing. All day long, young men could be found hanging around his lodge. Maidens flirted openly with him. His name was foremost in everyone's thoughts. No conversation, regardless of subject, could run its course without some mention of Dances with Wolves. The ultimate accolade came from Ten Bears. In a gesture previously unknown, he presented the hero with a pipe from his own lodge. Dances with Wolves liked the attention, but he did nothing to encourage it. The instant and lasting celebrity pressured the management of his days. It seemed that someone was always underfoot. Worst of all, it gave him little private time with Stance with the Fist. Of all the people in camp, he was perhaps the most relieved to see the return of Kicking Bird and Wind in His Hair. After several weeks on the trail, they had yet to engage the enemy, when sudden and unseasonable snow flurries caught them in the foothills of a mountain range. Interpreting this as a sign of an early and savage winter, Kicking Bird had called off the expedition, and they had flown home to make preparations for the big move south. If the party had any misgivings about returning empty-handed, they were washed away with the incredible news of the Pawnee rout. One immediate side effect of the homecoming was that it reduced the heat of celebrity that Dances with Wolves had been subjected to. He was no less revered, but because of their traditional high standing, much attention was shifted back to Kicking Bird and Wind in His Hair, and something approximating the old routine was reestablished. Though he made no public demonstration, Kicking Bird was astounded by Dances with Wolves' progress. His bravery and ability in repelling the Pawnee attack could not be overlooked, but it was his progress as a Comanche, particularly his mastery of the language, that moved the medicine man. He had sought only to learn something of the white race, and it was hard, even for a man of Kicking Bird's experience, to accept the fact that this lone white soldier, who months ago had never seen an Indian, was now a Comanche. Harder to believe was that he had become a leader of other Comanches, but the evidence was there for all to see, in the young men who sought him out, and in the way all the people talked. Kicking Bird could not figure out why all this had happened. He finally came to the conclusion that it was just another part of the great mystery that surrounded the Great Spirit. It was fortunate that he was able to accept these rapid developments. It helped pave the way for yet another surprise. His wife told him about it as they lay in bed on his first night back. "Are you certain of this?" he asked, thoroughly confounded. "This is hard for me to believe." "When you see them together, you will know," she whispered confidentially. It is there for all to see. Does it seem a good thing? His wife answered this question with a giggle. Isn't it always a good thing? She teased, squeezing a little closer to him. First thing next morning, Kicking Bird appeared at the celebrity's lodge flap, his face so clouded that Dances with Wolves was taken aback. They exchanged greetings and sat down. Dances with Wolves had just begun to pack his new pipe when Kicking Bird, in an unusual display of bad manners, interrupted his host. You are speaking well, he said. Dances with Wolves stopped working the tobacco into the bowl. Thank you, he replied. I like to speak Comanche. Then tell me, what is this between you and Stands with a Fist? Dances with Wolves nearly dropped his pipe. He stammered a few unintelligible sounds before he finally got something coherent out. What do you mean? Kicking Bird's face flushed angrily as he repeated himself. Is there something between you and her? Dances with Wolves didn't like this tone. His answer was framed like a challenge. I love her. You want to marry her? Yes. Kicking Bird thought on this. He would have objected to love for its own sake, but he could find nothing to disapprove of so long as it was housed in matrimony. He got to his feet. Wait here in the lodge, he said sternly. Before Dances with Wolves could reply, the medicine man was gone. He would have said yes at any rate. Kicking Bird's brusque manner had put the fear of God into him. He sat where he was.